Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Spencer Chase. Our guest this week is South Dakota Republican Dusty Johnson, who joins us to discuss this week's hearings focused on the cattle industry. But first, here's this week's headlines. The Biden administration is investing big bucks in food aid for Yemen and five African countries. All told, the Department of Agriculture plans to spend the entirety of a $282 million humanitarian trust to buy American commodities like wheat for food aid. There will also be another $388 million investment from the Commodity Credit Corps to cover shipping and handling of the commodities. As we discussed on last week's show, many African countries rely on the Black Sea region for their wheat, presenting acquisition challenges as the war there continues. The Surface Transportation Board played host to a hearing that included a healthy amount of frustration from the ag community. USDA Deputy Ag Secretary Jule Bernal was among the speakers who called for greater transparency and data reporting from the nation's rail shippers. Representatives from several farm groups also testified, including the National Grain and Feed Association. NGFA said its members currently face a daily risk of having to slow or shut down their operations based on inconsistent rail service. And finally, cattle industry leaders testified in a pair of Ag Committee hearings on Capitol Hill. On Tuesday, Senate Ag examined a pair of industry bills, including a measure to require certain amounts of cash trade in different regions throughout the country. Then on Wednesday, House Ag members questioned a panel of ranchers and the CEOs of the four largest meat packers in the country. South Dakota Republican Dusty Johnson has been actively involved in cattle policy discussions in recent years and has introduced a handful of bills on the subject. When we spoke to him, we asked him, after 8.5 hours of testimony and a baker's dozen worth of witnesses, where does Congress go from here?
Well, I think the marching orders are pretty clear, and they've been clear for a couple of years. You know, you had this great gathering of six organizations in Phoenix a couple of years ago, and they settled on a three-prong approach, focus on transparency, focus on building additional capacity, and focus on enforcement. That's what I've been working on. Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that we heard yesterday was Chairman Scott talking about, as the hearing wrapped up, that he was working on legislation to address what he called beef industry market imbalances. What form would you expect that legislation to take?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I do know that Chairman Scott seems to be a face. He said he's keeping an open mind, but he really seems to be listening a lot to Senator Grassley and Senator Grassley's approaches. And there are lots of good things in the Fisher-Grassley bill, but there are also things in that bill that are not consistent with the areas of consensus coming out of the Phoenix meeting. And I would just say this, we have made slower progress on beef market, cattle market policies in the past because we haven't been able to unify the livestock industry. We've been fighting with one another. That's why it's so important to focus on those consensus areas that came out of the Phoenix meeting. I just hope David Scott, as he moves forward, works on things related to transparency, adding capacity outside of the big four, and then enforcement. If he does something other than that, it could be counterproductive.
And one of the things that I didn't hear in the things that you were hoping for there was a regional cash trade mandate. That's obviously such a big piece of that Fisher and Grassley bill. Wondering, in your mind, we see that bill has a ton of support in the Senate, quite a bit of co-sponsors, a number of which are on the Senate Agriculture Committee. Your thoughts on the prospects of that legislation in the House?
Well, I think our number one goal when we're dealing with the cattle markets is, number one, do no harm to producers and consumers. And I don't know, you know, maybe 50-14 or maybe regional numbers could be a good thing. We just don't have enough evidence that that's the case yet. The overwhelming majority of studies that have analyzed this indicate that it could have negative repercussions for producers. Listen, I don't know what the truth is, but I do know that what we should do in the first instance is gather more information about AMAs, like through my cattle contract library. Then I think we'll be better positioned to make long-term decisions in a way that might not negatively impact producers.
One of the things that we heard yesterday from that hearing was the president of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association sort of asking Congress to take a bit of a hands-off approach on this issue until there are more results seen from the Department of Justice investigation. That was one of the things that they asked for coming out of that Phoenix meeting, was an update on the DOJ investigation as well. But waiting until DOJ has acted, do you think that's a realistic timeline for Congress?
Well, I think you need to take everything that he said, Mr. Schieffelbein, in context. I mean, he did talk about moving forward on those three areas of agreement. I mean, he did explicitly endorse My Cattle Contract Library and the Spanberger-Johnson Butcher Block Act. So it's not like he was saying just tread water until DOJ actually shows us the receipts. I think he was talking about, you know, before we make much larger, less predictable changes to the market, let's make sure we've got better information at hand. And I understand where he's coming from.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard anything from DOJ at this point about the status of their investigation?
No, and honestly, I don't expect that we would. I mean, that's disappointment. I think, you know, one thing that Mr. Schieffelbein said yesterday is that the monsters under the bed go away when you turn on the light. And it is amazing how important it can be to have light shed on these issues. I don't think it's good for the packers. It's not good for producers. It's not good for consumers to have the DOJ work, or in different instances, P&S work being done behind closed doors. I mean, let's have them do their investigation, and then regardless of what they find, let's have them release their findings. That's not their standard operating procedure. In general, they only release a report if they find wrongdoing. I think that's the wrong approach.
We'll be right back with more from Johnson right after this.
Regenerative poultry production is a process by which nature can actually recapture and restore the energy that is being taken out of a space.
Farm Credit helped Rahi build his dream of regenerative poultry farming and encouraging fellow immigrants to find community in agriculture.
Nothing beats a farm. I'm just pursuing happiness.
Learn more at farmcredit.com/beginning.
Welcome back. After a thorough discussion of the hearings that took place on Capitol Hill this week, we turned our discussion with Johnson to a broader look at the beef industry's reform efforts that lie ahead, and also some other legislative issues.
Well, I try not to complain about being frustrated with the pace of Congress, because it seems like it's all too easy for members to do that. But I would say we passed out My Cattle Contract Library back in December. It had 410 yes votes. The Senate could have done this thing by UC the next day. You know, they've chosen not to. And unfortunately, this is like, 10th verse, same as the first when it comes to, you know, cattle policies. We too often in the livestock space let the perfect be the enemy of the good. You know, oh, the cattle contract library isn't a silver bullet, so let's just not act on it. You know, we'd be better off if we had that thing implemented now, gathering information, pulling back the screen on alternative marketing agreements, giving us more information. We'd be better positioned to take the next step. This is a marathon. If we don't ever take that first step, we're never going to cross the finish line. And so as far as the timeline, I feel like we really need the Senate to be willing to take this first step with us. And then let's talk about what the second step looks like.
Mm-hmm. Another piece of legislation that you've been involved in, kind of shifting away from cattle politics, has been that Ocean Shipping Reform Act. We've seen House action, we've seen some Senate action, but the action has not been on identical pieces of legislation. Where do we go from here on that? Is this an issue where the House is going to accept the Senate language, or is this an issue where you expect some kind of conference?
Well, I'm not getting a lot of sense from my colleagues that they want to take the Senate bill. You know, I think there are some good things in the Senate legislation. There are frankly more areas of agreement between the House and Senate than there are areas of discrepancy. But I've talked to a lot of key leaders, and this is particularly true on the Democratic side, who just feel like the Senate bill doesn't do enough. They want reciprocity, clean and plain in the language. They want service standards clean and plain in the language. They don't want to just kick this can. It's been 25 years since we've adjusted these maritime laws. To the extent that it's going to be another 25 years, I hope it's not. But if it is, let's not act too tentatively here. And I think that's what I'm hearing from my colleagues. And so I think it's far more likely that we're going to try to reach some middle ground in a larger package like the China bill than we'll just take the Senate package on its own, or the Senate bill on its own.
Mm-hmm. as we look forward, obviously, we're looking at the midterm elections coming up later this year. Prevailing wisdom at this point is the expectation of House Republican control of not only Congress, of the House, but also of the House Agriculture Committee. And that is under the, under the lens of the 2023 Farm Bill reauthorization coming up. Wondering, as a member of the House Ag Committee on the Republican side of the aisle, how would Republican control of that committee influence the final product that would be that 2023 Farm Bill?
I would tell you, I am really looking forward to the 2023 Farm Bill. I think we've got some important areas that we can make some improvements. And I think one area where I've been a little disappointed with my Democratic colleagues is how slow we have been to get some of these hearings on what the 2023 Farm Bill should look like. I feel like we're just a little bit out of position. And I know on the Republican side, we're chomping at the bit. I mean, we've got plans, we've got areas. There's a strategy for how we would proceed in January to try to close that distance so that we can be in a better position to get a quality work product, which is obviously also going to be stakeholder driven. We don't want to just do this with the politicians. The beautiful thing about the Farm Bill generally is how collaborative it has been. We're going to be looking to do a lot more of that, at least if I'm a chairman of a subcommittee, and I would have every expectation I would be. I want to make sure it's not just me coming up with these ideas.
What's the top of the oversight list? You know, if the Republicans have this January plan, what are the oversight ideas that they're going to be looking to gather information on sort of at the top of the list?
Well, I do think you hear from cattle country some interest in some additional risk mitigation measures. I think on the crop side, people are concerned about reference prices and whether or not they're at the right spot on a go-forward basis. I think people are concerned about the size of ad hoc disaster relief, and they want to think a little bit about whether or not we're in the right position there. Those are three that come off at the top of my mind, but there are other lists out there as well.
And quickly, as we wrap up here today, Congressman, we saw the Biden administration earlier this month use some emergency authority to allow summertime E15 sales. I think there's general consensus that the cleanest way to make this a permanent fix as opposed to an administration by administration move would be an act of Congress. Is Congress going to act?
We need to act. This is an area of bipartisan agreement. And to me, I don't even really understand the argument against E15. The reality is its reed vapor pressure is lower than E10. So smog is less of a concern. Clearly, you know, once fully implemented, it could put another 8 billion gallons of liquid fuels onto the marketplace. For people who are concerned about, gas prices, that would have a big impact. And so this is the kind of thing we need to do. I am concerned that some of the purists on the environmental left are standing in the way, but I think we can build a very large bipartisan coalition to move this, and we should.
Congressman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll be right back to discuss this week's news with our panel, but first, Hannah Pegel takes a look at the distribution of the food dollar in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
The COVID-19 pandemic made many consumers think twice about where and how they are spending their money. And USDA's Economic Research Service provides some insight. Following the National Emergency Declaration on March 13, 2020, many states began to issue measures like the closure of in-person dining at restaurants and other food service businesses. At-home cooking increased dramatically, much to the dismay of the restaurant industry. At the onset of the pandemic, the average spending at restaurants from March through May 2020 plummeted 29% compared with the same period in 2019. That's a drop of about $7 billion. Spending remained below previous year levels for all restaurants throughout the remainder of 2020. Average spending at quick service restaurants, where you can pick up foods like burgers and pizzas, also declined during the pandemic, but not as much. That decline totaled about $3 billion. But starting in July of 2020, spending at quick service restaurants picked up and continued to climb into 2021. Many restaurants followed that trend by preparing more food to go. However, spending at full service restaurants has yet to return to pre-pandemic levels. Of course, the one number that farmers always ask about is how much of the food dollar actually ends up back on the farm. ERS says that for every dollar spent in 2020 on domestically produced food, the farm share was just 16 cents, while the marketing bill was 84 cents. For this week's Ag by the Numbers, I'm Hannah Pegel.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together. We celebrate together. But we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers' back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
Welcome back to AgriPulse Newsmakers. Happy to be joined by really a great panel this week to discuss a pretty busy week in beef policy circles. Joined now by Mark Dopp with the North American Meat Institute, Leah Biondo with the U.S. Cattlemen's Association, and Ethan Lane with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. And Ethan, I want to go to you first because we had kind of a couple of marathon hearings this week in both the House and Senate Agriculture Committee. A lot of discussion, and that's on top of some of the previous hearings and previous discussion that we've seen on this issue. Are we any closer sitting here right now to some kind of a legislative solution than we were at the beginning of the week?
Well, I think we're incredibly close to a legislative solution that works for cattle producers across the country and should work for the vast majority of lawmakers that have been working on this issue for 2 years and I guess what now, seven hearings in different committees across Capitol Hill. It was abundantly clear from the hearings on both the Senate and House sides that the only point of contention is this lingering mandate discussion. And, you know, it's obvious that the entirety of the economic community, the vast majority of cattle producers, certainly those producers that actually engage in that segment of fat cattle trade, just don't want that solution. But that shouldn't dissuade us from working on the huge array of other items that have been generated over several years of discussion here. There's a lot of good stuff that we should be working on to try to improve this marketplace.
And Mark, as we get the packer perspective here, wondering how would your industry react to, obviously the Grassley-Fisher legislation has that requirements to increase and mandate the amount of cash trade throughout certain regions. How would your industry react to such a requirement?
Well, not well. You know, it's no secret. We oppose the Grassley-Fisher legislation. We oppose I agree with Ethan. We oppose the mandate, and there are other aspects of the Grassley-Fisher legislation that we're troubled by. This office of a special investigator with respect to packers' stockyards to us seems wholly redundant. But back to the mandate, you know, government interference and government mandates are never a good idea. It seems to us that a mandate, as you see in the Grassley-Fisher legislation, is simply telling producers in particular, it's government interference. It's telling producers how they have to market their cattle. And basically it's picking winners and losers in the marketplace. So we're opposed to it. We're opposed to other aspects of the Grassley-Fisher bill.
What is the issue for packers with the increased participation in the cash market? Why do we not see more participation there as the market currently stands?
Again, I'm back to the fundamental point of it takes two to make a contract, right? So if you have AMAs being used by producers or offered or being requested by producers, and that's how they want to market their cattle, then producers, especially as we saw from all of the economic analysis done with respect to Grassley-Fisher and the incredible costs that it would impose in the Southern Plains and Texas and Oklahoma, New Mexico, et cetera, you know, again, the government shouldn't be intruding. I can't think of another industry in which the government tells companies how they have to buy their inputs. And that's, you know, again, it's the government picking winners and losers in the marketplace. And we're opposed to that.
So, Leah, we've heard from two groups now that are opposed to that legislation on the panel, but U.S. Cattlemen's stands in support of that legislation. Walk us through why USCA feels this is the right approach.
Yeah, Spencer, I don't mean to point out the obvious here, but of course the two market participants that are primary suspects of the Grassley-Fisher bill would be opposed to it. Those producers that enter into alternative marking arrangements have a great thing going for them. So I don't blame them for wanting to not be forced out of that market. And of course, this bill doesn't even attest to that. So, you know, we're not picking winners or losers. This isn't a new regulation. This is simply putting sideboards on an existing regulation, which is the mandatory price reporting program. We know that there's research out there that a thinning cash marketplace causes issues in the cattle marketplace. It leads to vertically integrated industry. And so what we're hoping to do here is prevent the cattle industry from going the way of the chicken or hog industries in terms of becoming vertically integrated. And of course, one of those primary components of an alternative marketing arrangement is you have to promise your cattle, your entire cattle supply, to just one packer, thus beginning a vertically integrated industry.
Mm-hmm. But Leah, we also saw this week some analysis, and it was a repeated economic analysis, that maybe the price discovery that could be produced as a result of this legislation might not, or the price transparency might not necessarily lead to better price discovery, might not lead to better prices. USDA's thoughts?
Of course. So Dr. Coons put out his own analysis of the bill and has stated that this idea of a thinning negotiated cash trade is his entire life's work. We have yet to see Dr. Coons put out a solution that works for him, frankly. The solution that works for the U.S. Cattlemen's Association is mandating this minimum negotiated cash trade.
We'll be right back with more from our panel right after this.
Looking closer, seeing further. That's how we do it. At Curious Plot, we're driven to find what's next for agriculture, animal care, and food. We stay curious because that's what it takes to grow understanding. That's how we plot strategies and tell stories that get results time after time. Marketing, communications, and consulting that look closer and see further. Curious Plot. We can't wait to help you tell your story.
Welcome back. Wednesday's House Agriculture Committee hearing included a pointed question directed at the leaders of the meatpacking companies about whether or not collusion was taking place in their industry. We asked NAMI lobbyist Mark Dopp his thoughts on that question and the hearing as a whole.
These allegations about collusion, the four CEOs responded absolutely correctly, and we reject categorically and unequivocally any such allegations. They're completely unfounded. So, I mean, frankly, I thought the question yesterday was a little bit out of bounds.
So, that being said, can the sector be competitive for producers and still profitable for packers? Is that solution out there?
Absolutely. We need to remember a couple things. The four firm concentration ratio, they talk about the big four, that status has been in place for the better part of 30 years. And in that time frame, we've seen packers make money, we've seen producers make money. And the cycle is what it is. I mean, Mr. Scott's chart yesterday showing how the packer margin had gone up starting in 2015 is incomplete, because it didn't show the significant margins that producers were making in the 5 years before that. So, you know, we need to have a complete picture here. You heard time and time again yesterday about the cattle cycle and how there are times when the packers make money and there are times when the producers make money. That's just the way it is, and that's likely to be the way it always is. And let me also say, with respect to Leah's comment about vertical integration, at least one of the CEOs yesterday said that he did not foresee, nor do I foresee, the type of vertical integration occurring in the cattle industry that has occurred elsewhere, in the chicken industry in particular. One other point to make, we need to remember also, and this came across yesterday with respect to the first panel, The panelists, and I thought, by the way, Mr. Scheffelbein did a very, very nice job. Those cow-calf producers that were on the first panel do not sell to the packers. So there's an intermediary in there. You know, we've got to remember how this industry is structured. There's the cow-calf, there's stockers, there's backgrounders, feedlot packers, and then the retail and food service community. That's the system we should be talking about.
Ethan, I want to bring you back into the fold here, because one of the things that we heard from your organization's president was that NCBA would like Congress to maybe take a step back from considering some legislative solutions until there's conclusion to a Department of Justice investigation. But DOJ, as we've seen, typically does not offer updates, unless, short of indictments. What then if DOJ never formally concludes the investigation, never concludes that indictments are necessary? What then on the legislative path forward?
Well, certainly I think them not moving forward with indictments is a good indication of the results of their investigation. That doesn't mean we don't have a really important task ahead of us in ensuring that proper oversight is occurring at Packers and Stockyards. We've talked a lot about the need to make sure that that division functions properly, is adequately funded and adequately staffed. That's not the case at the moment. Creating a new separate entity to compete with P&S inside USDA is not solving the underlying problem. We have a department that needs to be improved and funded so that it can carry out its mission. That ought to be job number one in ensuring that the marketplace has proper oversight.
And Leah, just wrapping things up here, obviously a lot of discussion going on, but a lot of potential timelines coming up. There's LMR at the end of September. There's the Farm Bill coming up. What does USDA and what do you see as sort of the legislative path forward here as we look at timelines?
Well, we are running out of time to get something happened or passed this year. We are facing, as you said, a deadline of mandatory price reporting expiring September 30th. We have midterm elections coming up at the end of the year and then a new Congress starting again next year. So our timelines are very, very limited here. And I cannot stress that this effort to mandate a minimum negotiated cash trade is entirely driven by grassroots producers. U.S. Cattlemen's Association, we don't manage a political action committee or a PAC. We don't contribute to any of these congressional members, House or Senate. And so the reason that you saw so many of those members of Congress at the House and Senate hearings this week vehemently defending this Fisher-Grassley bill is because they're hearing constituents in their states. You just can't fake that kind of grassroots effort. And so we are running out of time. We did have this hearing on the bill in the Senate on Tuesday. Our next ask would be for the Senate Agriculture Committee to hold a vote on this bill, an up or down vote, and really get this moving to the Senate floor and over to the House as quickly as possible.
So obviously a bit of a challenge to try and summarize about 8.5 hours worth of congressional testimony and a 10-minute conversation amongst four people. But I appreciate all of you joining me to give that a shot. So Mark, Leah, and Ethan, appreciate your time.
Happy to do it. Thank you.
We'll be right back with more AgriPulse Newsmakers. But first, our Hannah Pagel takes a look at the state of drought in the country in this week's Map It Out.
If you are a farmer in the West or Southern Plains, you may be worried about producing a good crop this year, especially with the abnormally dry conditions that occurred this winter and the small chance for rain in the coming weeks. In California, farmers are seeing little relief after the driest two-year period on record. The Northern California Water Association expects about 370,000 acres of farmland to be left fallow in the Sacramento Valley this year, which could lower the state's rice production. Swaths of Texas, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Kansas, Nevada, and Oregon are experiencing what the U.S. Weather Service calls exceptional drought. This type of drought leads to major crop and pasture losses for farmers, a heightened risk of wildfires, and water shortages in reservoirs. Several other regions, including Utah, Montana, and Nebraska, aren't faring much better, despite having slightly more rainfall. These dry conditions are partly linked to reoccurring weather patterns. Every 3 to 7 years, waters in the Pacific near the equator cool down, causing the jet stream to push northward. This event is best known as La Niña. The result is warmer, drier weather in the south. These conditions are particularly noticeable in Texas, where producers are experiencing the driest September to March period they've seen since 1967. Some producers in Texas are saying this year's conditions remind them of the conditions seen in 2011, when one of the state's most destructive droughts led to over $7 billion in losses for farmers. According to USDA's latest crop production report, just under 80% of the state's winter wheat crop is rated very poor to poor, and many other crops have yet to be planted. This drought only adds to concerns about a global food crisis, especially since Russia and Ukraine together account for 1/3 of the world's wheat supply. Noah Wicks has more details in his story on AgriPulse.com. For this week's Map It Out, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Did you know AgriPulse has all your favorite podcasts, including Open Mic, Newsmakers, and Drive Time? Take us wherever you go. Subscribe at AgriPulse.com or on Spotify, Google Play, or Apple Podcasts.
Agriculture Future of America is a nonprofit building transformational leaders in food and agriculture. AFA prepares college students to join the workforce as innovative and engaged young professionals who will shape the future of agriculture. Head to agfuture.org to find out how you can get involved.
Thanks again for tuning in for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Before we let you go, here's what's on the horizon for the week to come. The House will not be in town, but the Senate will be in session. A Senate Appropriations Subcommittee plans to convene a Wednesday hearing to look into the budget for the Forest Service. USDA plans to reopen its weekly farmers markets and the People's Garden, giving the public a look at agriculture on the National Mall. and I'm looking forward to welcoming my friends from the National Association of Farm Broadcasting for our annual Washington Watch event. As always, stay tuned for the latest developments in food and ag policy on AgriPulse.com. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Spencer Chase. Have a good one.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit AgriPulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.